Now we're back to the democracy side on the left, with the Federal Reserve at the top. Why? The rule of law is the golden rule. Whoever controls the gold makes the rules. So we have to put the Federal Reserve now in charge of the United States government. So we, and by the way, that's a foreign financial power now, so we're going to draw a line down from it to the United States government. We define the United States government as the District of Columbia, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and those territories ceded to it by the states. Now we're going to include one other jurisdiction that you may be unfamiliar with. We're going to go to Article 14, which most people refer to as the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Under Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, just go ahead and underline here United States and state, because we're defining two different jurisdictions here. And as you recall, back in Article 1, Section 8, Clause number 17 of the Constitution, it says that the USDC jurisdiction had the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the considerable legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, and dockyards and other needful buildings. So we see there that there's a jurisdiction of the United States, there's a jurisdiction of the state, which are totally different jurisdictions. The United States have specifically assigned jurisdictional authorities in the Constitution of the United States. The state government has specifically assigned jurisdictional authority in the Constitution of the state. And anything we did not give to the state in the United States is our power, our jurisdiction. Now, back to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. To give you a little bit of a background and history on this, this came about as a result of the Civil War, and this was an amendment that was to free the slaves from bondage to the plantation owners in the South. So what the United States jurisdiction did is it released them from bondage of the plantation owners and put them under the bondage of the United States government. And this is what it was particularly written for, because those bound slaves did not have any status to be citizens of the state. Therefore, the United States government created a new jurisdiction of citizens, or rather of citizenship for those black slaves. And it's all persons, once again, and by the way, that was at that time the black slaves of the South born or naturalized in the United States, which is what? The District of Columbia, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So they had a dual citizenship of the United States and the state, whereas the other people only had a citizenship of the state or citizenship of the United States, but not this new dual citizenship that we see here now. Now, we want to go over now to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution, where it says the Congress shall have the power, and in Clause 3 it says to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So we see here that the Congress has the power to govern interstate commercial regulation. So if we look back at the 14th Amendment again, we see that the citizenship given to the black slaves of the South was a citizenship between the United States and the state, which is an interstate commercial regulatory power that they were exercising. So how does this apply now? All the black slaves are all dead. They're not alive anymore. The ones that are being born now, of course, are natural born citizens of the United States of America, a citizen of the state wherein they reside. So how does this apply now, because all those black slaves are dead? Well, the application of it is, when you get a Social Security number, you are engaging in an interstate commercial contract with the Social Security Administration, an enclave of the United States D.C. jurisdiction. Remember, your Social Security number is good in every state of the Union. It's good internationally. So I'm going to ask you a question. Are you a citizen of the United States, a citizen of the state wherein you reside, or are you a citizen of the United States and the state wherein you reside, or are you an international one-world citizen? Well, here's the some facts on that. If you have a Social Security card, you can live in any country that you want to, but as a United States citizen with a Social Security card, you're required to file and report and pay on your income no matter where you're living in the world. Number one. Number two, and the reason for that, you're eligible for benefits no matter where you live in the world. So if you have a disability someplace in, you know, where you're living in some other part of the world, the United States D.C. jurisdiction still has to pay you for those disability benefits. If you retire in some other country of the world, they have to pay your retirement pay, even though you're not living here in this country. So in reality, if you have a Social Security card, you are a one-world citizen. So the question is when are they going to establish the one-world government? Well, they already have the one-world court. They already have the United Nations International Peacekeeping Force, and they have the one-world citizen. So the one-world government is in full force and has been for many years. I've been asked the question many times is, when do you think that we're going to go to a cashless society? And I say, well, how about 1933? That's when Franklin Delano Roosevelt declared an emergency. They made it illegal for Americans to hold gold. They went on a house-to-house search for gold. They stole the gold out of the banks and, of course, left the people with the worthless paper currencies. Well, a cashless society would mean a society without gold and silver as our money supply. Well, they stopped with the gold in 1933. They stopped with the silver in 1964, and they closed the gold window to international trade in 1971. So we have been on a cashless society already for a long period of time. We are, you know, Federal Reserve notes are cashless, is cashless money. Bookkeeping entries are cashless money. So we're already there. As a matter of fact, you're paying to print up and counterfeit your own so-called Federal Reserve bookkeeping entries when you write a check. So they've got you conned into paying for your own commercial paper to transfer those funds in the economy for value. Now, I'm not going to say that all this, you know, commercial paper is bad. And it's not it being bad that is the problem. It's that it's in the hands of a foreign financial power that is, you know, controlling our government in a direction of unconstitutionality. That is the problem. In other words, we the people, whatever kind of a commercial paper that we would like to pass between each other as notes to transfer wealth, it's fine. That's our business. It's not theirs. They have no business being in that jurisdiction because that's our jurisdiction. It is not their jurisdiction. Now, back to the democracy side of this piece of paper, we have the Federal Reserve over the United States government. The Federal Reserve Act required the United States government pay to borrow counterfeit paper currencies into the economy, and they had to pay that back in gold at the current interest rate. And that current interest rate could be anywhere from like 3 to 13% interest. That drains the gold out of the Treasury and into the Federal Reserve vaults in New York City for borrowing counterfeit paper currencies into the economy. Now, that allows the U.S. government to borrow whatever they want to borrow to fund government. Now, they're running a $500 billion budget deficit. That means they're introducing $500 billion more in the economy every year than what they're taking in. That means they're creating wild and uncontrollable inflation because they're getting something for nothing. So that's spent into government. The only way governments can get counterfeit money circulating in the economy is they have to spend it in. Well, the spending of that in necessarily creates massive government. Have you ever wondered where all this massive government is coming from? It's because they're spending wealth into circulation, whereas in the Republican form of government, they're creating the wealth first. The people mine for the gold and silver. They create the wealth by digging it out of the ground. Then they submit it to the National Mint. The National Mint will mint it into coin form, take a percentage for the coinage charge, which is the excise tax on that coin. It goes back to the people. Now the people spend it in the circulation. So the wealth is created before it's taxed, and it's spent in the circulation after the wealth is created. Whereas in the democracy, they're creating debt off of a counterfeiting operation, introducing that in the economy as wealth. Now they're getting for something for nothing, and they have to spend it in. Therefore, massive government results, which means that we have to build all these new agencies of government to regulate the people, because that's all government does is regulate, in order to spend it into circulation. And that's the only purpose for it. In other words, if we did not allow them to counterfeit paper currencies off the printing press, they would necessarily have to abolish approximately 50% of the democracy, which would mean that that would start transforming that back to a Republican form of government, remembering that our government was based on minimum government. not maximum government. The democracy is maximum government. The Republican form of government is minimum government. So now we have the United States government spending these funds in the circulation, and they do revenue sharing with the states. So the funds are spent in the states. And the states and the U.S. government spend them in the circulation, and the people get a hold of those funds, and they go out and buy property with it. So on your piece of paper, under United States government, first of all, you got the Federal Reserve, draw a line to United States government, and then down to the state, and down to the people, and under the people, put an arrow down to the acquisition of property. Now, when you look at this chart, you're going to see it's the opposite of the Republican form of government. Now the people are on the bottom, buying property with Federal Reserve notes. Now I'm going to ask you a question. Draw a line now from the U.S. government and put the IRS up there, down to the people, and we're going to say now, right on there, that the IRS can manufacture a lien, levy, and seize that property that you have purchased with Federal Reserve notes, and write down with there with no due process of law. There is trial by jury. There's no determination of any kind of a liability by a trial by jury. The Internal Revenue Service merely liens, levies the property, and they take it away from you by some kind of an erroneous false or claim of some sort that you owe them taxes that you haven't paid. And they just simply take it away. Okay, so why is that true? Well, number one, over in the Republican form of government, you are a member of the people over the government. In the democracy, you're a member of the people under the government. So draw a line from the people under the Republican form of government down to the people on the democracy and ask yourself, how was it that you descended from this high level of sovereignty over the government to this low level of servitude to the government? Well, remember, in the Republican form of government, you did not go to the government for benefits. You paid them to work for you. You were their servant. You paid them in gold and silver to serve you. Were their servant. You paid them in gold and silver to serve you. Whereas in the democracy, you are now going up to the government and begging for benefits. Okay, the rule of law is you owe your servitude to whoever you receive your benefits from. Now that you're a benefited slave of the state, they have a vested ownership in you. And when you descended to that level, you did it by getting a Social Security number eligible for benefits. Now you owe your servitude to the U.S. government for the benefits you made yourself eligible for. Now you are a slave, servant of them. And you might want to check the biblical tape out on Genesis 47 that will explain how people go into bondage and also show you how you can get out of bondage. Now, number two, you're using Federal Reserve notes to make the acquisition of property. Federal Reserve notes are those counterfeited by a foreign financial power, the Federal Reserve. They did not sell these counterfeit paper currencies to the United States government for circulation in the economy. They rented them into circulation. Therefore, the U.S. government has to pay a rent charge in order to use them. That means when you acquired the Federal Reserve notes for your labor, you acquired the use of someone else's property, but not ownership over the Federal Reserve notes. So when you bought the property with the Federal Reserve notes, that property became owned by the Federal Reserve, the foreign financial power, and the IRS is an enforcement agency for the Federal Reserve and therefore has the power to take their property back away from you. That's why no due process of law is required for them to seize and sell that property that you believe was yours, because it's really theirs, it's not yours. You just have the illusion of property ownership from an equitable interest in the property, not real allodial ownership. Allodial means beholden to no one. It means that you have an absolute ownership right. You had not established that because you did not pay in gold and silver coin. You did not buy it as a sovereign free individual. You bought it as a slave. You registered with the government. You paid for it with Federal Reserve notes. It is what is called the Federal Reserve Eleemosynary Corporate Estate Trust. That gives them the power to take it away from you anytime they want to take it away without any due process of law. For example, if I rent you my car and you're using my car, by the way, the condition of renting you my car was that you cannot use it in a way that would be destructive to the car. And I rent it to you for $50, and I see you downtown abusing the car, and I just take it away from you. Do I have to have a court order to do that? No, I don't. Why? That's my property. It's not yours. I can just simply take it away. That's what they're doing. They're taking property away that belongs to them. It doesn't belong to you. So, bold statement. The Internal Revenue Service in this country has never liened, levied, seized, or sold anybody's property in this country. And the evidence of that is that you never owned it. If you had owned the property, they would not have taken that property from you because they would have no vested interest in it. They would have had to have due process law through courts of justice. All right, so here we are. We see in the democracy that the people are under the government's foot. And we see in the Republican form of government that the government is under the people's foot. It's exactly the opposite. So I think it's time that we just looked at some characteristics of the democracy, like we did in the Republican form of government. Okay, now, number one, the question is how many people that are listening to this tape were told the full disclosure of the nature of the income tax and the Social Security tax as insurance policies, and I should say insurance premiums to pay for insurance policies for benefits that you made yourself eligible for? I would venture to say that no one told you that. Next, I want to bring out a very, very important and startling fact, is that there has been no law ever passed in the history of the United States of America that required anybody to get a Social Security number or to use a Social Security number. Now, this is a letter, and I'm going to quote directly from it. I'll read it verbatim. This is a Social Security letter from the Social Security Administration, Department of Health and Human Services. This is dated April the 20th, 1990. This information is still current. Social Security does not require anyone to have a Social Security number. Other government agencies and employers require individuals to obtain numbers in order to participate in their programs. So here is the Social Security Administration admitting that no one's ever been required to have a number and that it is only to participate in the program. So what kind of programs are they talking about? Well, here's another letter from the Social Security Administration, Department of Health and Human Services. Social Security is a voluntary system in that no one is required to get a number. Okay, here it is again. They're admitting that you're not required to have a number, you're not required to use a number. However, programs which use Social Security numbers for control purposes might not allow a person without a Social Security number to participate. So if you don't have a Social Security number, you're going to be prohibited from participating in certain things. Let's see what those things are. The Internal Revenue Service uses Social Security numbers as a taxpayer identification number. In other words, if you have a Social Security number, you're identified as a taxpayer. This means if you don't have a Social Security number, you're identified as a non-taxpayer. Because the legal definition of a Social Security number is taxpayer's identification number. Public Law 87-397 was passed October the 5th of 61, requiring each taxpayer, now this only applies to people with a Social Security number because you're not identified as a taxpayer until you get one, they have to furnish an identifying number for tax reporting purposes. So people who did not have a Social Security number would be prohibited from reporting a number for tax reporting purposes because they would not have one. Because of this, employers must have the Social Security numbers for other workers to legally report their earnings, which means that people who are non-taxpayers without a number don't have to have their earnings reported because they're not income. They could not continue to employ an individual for whom they could not legally report earnings. So they could not employ you if they couldn't report your earnings, but they could hire you on an independent free enterprise contractual relationship basis because the government is prohibited from interfering with rights of contract per Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution of the United States of America. A bank or lending institution is not governed by the Social Security rules, but I doubt very much if they would refuse a loan simply because the applicant had no Social Security number. Well, I don't know of a bank that would loan you any funds without a Social Security number, but remember, you are supposed to be out of debt. You're to have no debt whatsoever, so therefore, if you didn't have a Social Security number and you couldn't borrow any funds, that would be to your betterment, not your detriment. However, a person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income, so therefore, one of your benefits, I should say one of your detriments of not having a Social Security number is you'd have no taxable income and you would not be able to pay the income tax. That would be a horrifying experience. Now, I've had that horrifying experience now for 15 years of not being a person required to have a Social Security number, not being a person required to have any taxable income, and I want you to know I will elect to go down that road any day. And I would encourage you to try the waters, they're warm and comfortable, just kind of stick your toe in and give it a shot. I think you'll love Freedom and Free Enterprise. It'll give you a new boost of energy and a challenge that'll bring you back to life and make you about 30 years younger. An inheritance large enough to be taxable would require the recipient to get a Social Security number for IRS purposes. The person leaving the inheritance would not be required to have a Social Security number just for this purpose. In other words, The properties controlled by the state in the state's trusteeship are under their control for inheritance purposes. Therefore, if you wanted to be a benefactor of an inheritance controlled by the government, you'd have to have a Social Security number. If you did not get that inheritance, you would not be required then to get a Social Security number, only for the benefit of getting a Social Security number. So on the democracy side, as part of the characteristics, let's put in lying. Lying is one of the characteristics that's prevalent through deceit, so you might want to put in deceit. Why? Because the true nature of these insurance programs was never divulged, and that's a huge violation of the consumer fraud laws. They need to be held accountable for those consumer fraud laws. Okay, now we also know that the Internal Revenue Service levies taxes, which are really insurance premium payments for benefits, through threats. So write down threats. Intimidation, write that down. Harassment, liens, levies, seizures, with no court orders, no due process of law. So these are characteristics of that. Not only that, I'm going to ask you all just point blank, how many of you, you know, have filed returns, signed them under the penalties of perjury, knowing that they were not true? You underreported your income, you overreported the deductions, and you signed under the penalties of perjury saying it's true and correct, so we would not have to pay as much tax. That's typical of a disobedient slave. They will lie, cheat, and steal in the tax returns to pay as little as possible and try to get as much out of the system as possible. And, of course, that's one of the reasons the system is collapsing, because people are finding all kinds of loopholes and ways to get out of it because they simply cannot afford to pay it. And of course, that creates inflationary pressures that creates the accumulation of this massive debt that will eventually collapse the system totally. So there's some pretty good definitions of the different characteristics in the two. A disobedient slave is defined as one who has a Social Security number. Might want to write that down. Has a Social Security number. Number two, maybe he doesn't file or to pay all that he is required to pay, and he probably is mad at the government, doesn't like what the government is doing. So they're in a category of being eligible for benefits, not wanting to pay for them, and maybe lying on returns, etc. A obedient slave would be one that has a Social Security number, is eligible for benefits, and pays all that he's required to pay to receive those benefits. So now we've defined obedient slaves, disobedient slaves, and free people. And the definitions of disobedient slaves and good slaves are fairly simple definitions, but the common denominator is that they have Social Security numbers, they've got the property registered in the system, and the government has got the power to tell them, if they don't do as they're told or else, the government's going to take everything away from them through liens, levies, and seizures. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want them to have that kind of power over me. Backup. We always want to back up what we're saying and give you facts, to give you an intelligent basis for this information, because I know this is probably hitting a lot of people right between the eyes, and it's difficult for you. If you just look at it from a logical point of view, common sense reasoning process, you'll see how it all fits together like a very, very neatly fitting puzzle. This is on the War and Emergency Powers. During World War I, the U.S. Congress passed the Trading with the Enemy Act, 12 U.S.C. Section 95A, October the 6th of 1997. This act was later amended in the Banking Relief Act of March the 9th, 1933, as Title 12, U.S.C. 95, Subparagraph B, Clause 1, Title 1, Section 48, Statutes 1. By means of that amendment, the United States has been operating under war and emergency power since March the 9th of 1933. Under the 1933 Banking Relief Act, the federal government declared the bank holiday of March 6, 1933, and relieved the banks from the contractual obligation to the American people of redeeming their Federal Reserve notes in gold. The Federal Reserve note originally constituted a warehouse receipt for real gold which the people had placed in deposit with the banks. The original Trading with the Enemy Act of October the 6th of 1917 was enacted at a time when the United States was at war with Germany, World War I, and is therefore constitutional under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, U.S. Constitution. Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures of land and water. The amended version 1933 of the original Trading with the Enemy Act 1917 was approved and passed by Congress on March 9, 1933. This amended version was enacted at a time when the United States was not at war with any foreign foe. Further, the amended version 1933 was radically different from the 1917 version. In 1917, the jurisdiction of the Trading with the Enemy Act excluded all citizens of the United States who conducted their business wholly within the United States. However, the 1933 amendment included citizens of the United States under its jurisdiction by adding the following language. Now, remember, United States citizens would include District of Columbia, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, territory ceded to it by the states for the protection of the country for forts, magazines, and arsenals. And by the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, it would include those people who had joined the USDC jurisdiction through some kind of an interstate commercial regulatory contract, i.e. Social Security card membership. So, once again, however, the 33 Amendment included citizens of the United States under its jurisdiction by adding the following language, by any person within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Under the amended version, 1933 of the 1917 Act, and by operation of law, the American people became the same as a foreign enemy of 1917. As such, all Americans were therefore subject to regulations, rules, licenses, orders, and proclamations issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury since March 4, 1933, and that's 12 U.S.C. 95, subparagraph B. After the American people were declared to be enemies, all legal and commercial intercourse became illegal, and the only way one could do business or any type of legal intercourse was to obtain permission from our government by means of a form of license by law. A license is a permit to do that which otherwise would be illegal. As you might expect, our government normally protects the United States by restricting the activities of enemies. For example, we wouldn't expect the federal government to allow communist agents to travel freely or open a business in our country. Nevertheless, there are times when the government might allow members of an enemy nation to travel from New York to Chicago. For example, when athletes of the former Soviet Union came to America, our government granted them a special permission license to do that travel, which would otherwise be prohibited for Russian agents. That our government might license foreigners who might be enemies is unremarkable. But who would ever imagine that our own government licensed us for the very same reason? Today, if one wants to travel, one has to have a driver's license. That's if, of course, they travel in a motor vehicle as opposed to a privately owned automobile. If one wants to open up a business, one has to have a business license. If one wants to work, one must obtain a license, Social Security card. As was predicted in the Bible, one cannot buy, sell, or trade without the mark. That's a license of a reprisal. By Executive Order 2039 of March 6, 1933, and Executive Order 2040 of March 9, 1933, the belligerent United States federal government, acting under the war power, seized title to all gold, lawful constitutional money, took physical possession of all the money, and left American people penniless, bankrupt, and without means to lawfully pay their debts. After the United States had seized title and took physical possession of the people's lawful money, the government found it necessary to issue a new form of currency in order for the people to carry on normal business transactions. This new currency was in the form of Federal Reserve banknotes, war and emergency currency, and not Federal Reserve notes, warehouse receipts for the gold. This new money will be worth 100 cents on the dollar because it is backed by the credit of the nation. It will represent a mortgage in all the homes and other property of all the people in the nation. And that's out of the Congressional Record, March the 9th, 1933. The people were now prohibited from being able to pay their debts at law, i.e. with lawful money, gold, and were forced to mortgage their goods and services to one of the banks or lending institutions in order to obtain Federal Reserve bank notes in order to discharge, not lawfully pay their debts. The people now, being classified as the enemy, also became the captured collateral property of the United States to secure the debt Federal Reserve bank notes. Now, this only applied to people that were United States citizens. Now, we have to understand that United States D.C. jurisdiction, once again, remember, it was at 10 miles square, and then it was the possessions of the U.S., District of Columbia, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and then it was territory ceded to the United States by the states for the defense of the country. So the citizens of the states were not affected by this. So they had to have a method to suck the people of the states, the citizens of the states, into their jurisdiction so they could collateralize their property as well. And that's where the con job of the Social Security Act came in, which is an interstate commercial contract governed by the USDC jurisdiction. So when you left the constitutional Republican form of government to go down to the low level of servitude to the democracy, what you did is submitted yourself into bondage to them by getting a Social Security number, making them required to give you benefits for the money that you would pay them for the benefits. And then on top of that, they collateralized all of your property as a condition of you becoming a slave to them and hypothecated it to the Federal Reserve as collateral for the debt that the United States government owed to the Federal Reserve. So all your body, your labor, and all the property was collateralized and hypothecated to the Federal Reserve in order for them to be able to print Federal Reserve notes and circulate in the economy for value to transfer goods and services. And if you go to the biblical tape, Genesis 47, you'll see how that was done in Genesis 47. And for those of you that don't like the biblical references, don't look at it as a preaching ceremony or something like that. Just look at it as a historical record of what happened at that time, what the people did, and you'll appreciate that as a historical record as to how people go into bondage and how you can come out of bondage. We're going to go on with a quote. The former judicial courts of justice, now took silent judicial notices of the maritime international NREM jurisdiction and took the role as executive officers, not judicial, to enforce the federal and state statutes in all cases whatsoever. The judges and lawyers, in essence, became nothing more than executive political hatchet men of their branch of government to enforce the public policy statute enacted by Congress and to force performance on this new commercial paper, Federal Reserve banknotes, in order to give it some sort of value. Once the people were declared to be the enemy, they lost all their unalienable rights under the unlawfully suspended Constitution and Bill of Rights. Since 1933, the American people have had no unalienable rights to life, liberty, and property. And I'm going to correct that, because this article I'm reading from says the American people, whereas really it should say the United States citizens lost their unalienable rights to life, liberty, and property. It's a matter of law that the question of jurisdiction can be raised at any time. Therefore, the only question before our courts is one of jurisdiction. And the jurisdictional issue is whether or not you're a United States citizen subject to the jurisdiction thereof in interstate commercial regulatory powers or territorially in the United States D.C. jurisdiction, which is 10 miles square in Washington, D.C., or in one of the possessions, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, or in one of the territories ceded to the D.C. jurisdiction by the states. And of course, the Social Security number is where most people will fall, because they've joined the interstate commercial regulatory power by joining that jurisdiction through these insurance contracts, these fraudulent insurance contracts. Now I want to present another authority. It's called the Book of the States, Council of States Governments. This Council of States Governments was created between 1922 and 1937, which shows that they had a long-range plan to eliminate our constitutional Republican form of government and institute the new democracy. Okay, this is part of the Council of States Governments policies for instituting this new government. And I want to remind you that this has started long before the Great Depression. So there was a conspiracy that the Council of States government supporters entered into to create the Great Depression and change our form of government from a constitutional Republican form of government to the democracy. And the Council of States government supporters wrote in Common Council, January the 22nd, 1937, the Declaration of Interdependence of the Governments within the United States of America. So, if you recall, our Founding Fathers wrote the Declaration of Independence, where we declared independence from Great Britain. Now, here they are writing the Declaration of Interdependence. Well, what does interdependence mean? That means that in order for there to be interdependence, that means everybody has to depend on everybody else. But really what interdependence means is that if I want to deal with you, I have to go through the government to deal with you, and the government gets a piece of every action that occurs between me and you. So basically they wanted to become a hub of an interdependent society that would allow them to control all the movements of goods and services and allow them to get a piece of the action of every one of those movements. Now here's what they said in the Declaration of Interdependence. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for a nation to repair the fabric which unites its many agencies of government and to restore the solidarity which is vital to orderly growth, it is the duty of responsible officials to define the need and to find a way to meet it. A way does not come of itself. The maintenance of just and efficient government is as intricate, as arduous, and as imperative as any human endeavor. 150 years ago, our forefathers faced their necessity and formed a new union. They found a way. And from that beginning in 1787 sprang history's finest example of the democratic form of government. Now, they're claiming the government that our founding fathers established was a democratic form of government. When Benjamin Franklin came out of the Constitutional Convention, he says, "We have given you a republic if you can keep it." So, we were never given a democratic form of government. We were given a constitutional republican form of government. A government dedicated to the preservation of every man's endowment of life, liberty, and happiness. Inevitable changes have come. The fundamental pattern of states united for the benefit of all the people remains the same as it was when the founding fathers wove it, but the far-flung tapestry of our many governments has stretched so taut that the fabric has weakened. The essential thread of cooperation too often is lacking. Now, for the first time, since that memorial day, when the form of our Constitution was determined, official delegates of the states are gathered together with representatives of the central government and with representatives of the local government as good neighbors seeking to revive the original purpose to form a more perfect union. It was meant that the states, while creating a nation, should yet preserve their own sovereignties and a maximum of self-government. So here they're admitting that the states are supposed to be sovereign, and they're sovereign over the national government. Now they go on to say, now, if the claim of states' rights is to prevail, it must be justified by demonstration of the states' competence. So now they're trying, see, this is their theory now to subvert the state's sovereignty to the will of the federal government. When our nation was formed, there was no land transportation nor any remote communication except by the plodding foot of horse or man. But since that time, our society has been revolutionized by the advent of transportation as swift as the wind and of communication more rapid than lightning. Our area has tripled. The number of our people has increased beyond belief. So these mere facts is what they're using to totally overthrow our constitutional form of government simply because we have more population and we have more scientific inventions. So what? That should not decrease in freedom. It should maximize our freedom. How have our governments met their mutual problems brought by this modern era? They have developed a no man's land of jurisdiction. So here they are claiming that the constitutional republican form of government has developed a no man's land of jurisdiction. What I want to know is what jurisdiction are they talking about? Well, the jurisdiction of the state government is a state constitution. The jurisdiction of the national government is a national constitution, the Constitution of the United States of America. So they are referring to we, the people's jurisdiction. They're referring to our jurisdiction as a no man's land of jurisdiction. So what they're conspiring to do here in this document is to invade and interfere with the jurisdiction of we, the people, the United States of America, so they can control everything we do and be able to get a piece of the action of everything that we spend. This is the conspiracy to overthrow our jurisdiction right here. It's right in the Council of States Governments. You can probably still get it from the libraries. It's going to be available for $100 a copy if people want to buy it. Yes, $100 is a lot for it, but it's a big document. It's worth $100. In thousands of instances, their laws are in conflict. They're talking about the Republic now. Their laws are in conflict. Their practices are discordant. Their regulations are antagonistic. And Turn the page, and policies are either competitive or repugnant to one another. Well, it sounds to me like they're talking about the democracy, because that's how it's operating now. In taxation alone, scores of conflicts between federal and state laws exist. The interstate criminal is a standing headline on page one of every newspaper. The question is, are things getting better or worse? It sounds like to me that it's worse now than what it was then. The 48 states passed laws on crime, labor, taxation, relief, corporations, parole, domestic relations, and other questions monumentous to our social and economic system, with no thought of harmony. And this discord has been further stitched into our pattern of life by all other agencies possessing the power of legislation. So it sounds to me like they have become the type of an organization that they were professing to overthrow and replace with the democracy. They go on to say, this is not as it should be. The trend of federal-state projects, exemplified by Social Security, demands immediate action if these projects are to succeed completely. So the impetus for enforcing these plans was the Social Security program. They had to suck the people out of the state citizenship jurisdiction and into the USDC jurisdiction to gain jurisdictional authority over them so they could collateralize their property, collateralize their labor to the benefit of the foreign financial power, the Federal Reserve, so they'd be able to control and tell everybody what to do who were citizens of the states. And this is the document that exposes that kind of a conspiracy. I think everybody ought to have a copy. I know it's expensive, but it's worth it. It's called out of the Council of States Governments, and I'm going to read from the part that says, Intergovernmental Cooperation, a compromise between the tyranny of centralization and the anarchy of decentralization. So what they're saying is that a centralized government is a tyrannical government. They're saying that in a decentralized government is an anarchy. So they're referring to the constitutional Republican form of government as being in anarchy. Well, you see, the reason that they're saying that it's an anarchy is because they can't control the people's jurisdiction, and government was never supposed to or given the power to control the people's jurisdiction. So they're viewing our jurisdiction as an anarchy to them, but government employees are not supposed to have any power to control our jurisdiction. So what they're after here, you see, what they're really after is they're after invading the people's jurisdiction and subverting us to be slaves of the USDC jurisdiction. They do admit that the centralized government is tyranny, and they're trying to make some kind of a compromise between these two. Okay, I have news for you folks. There's only two forms of government, democracy and republic, and you either have to live by the communistic rules in the democracy or the free rules in the republic. And when they tried to make this kind of a compromise, all they did was come out with a tyrannical democracy that the founding fathers said was the worst and most vile government ever created in the history of the world, because they call it mobocracy. What they set up a system of voting where the majority vote rules. Well, if you have the majority of the people getting a benefit from the government, the minority being producers, well, then the majority will vote away the productive rights of the minority and gradually destroy productivity in the country that they impose it in. That's what's happening in this country. They're destroying productivity through the implementation of a satanical, communistic democracy that is a tyrannical, lying, stealing, cheating government. The part that I'm going to read from is learning from experience. Then this is the con job they used to con people into accepting the conceptual ideas of how our government should run by the Council of States Governments. Okay, once again, learning from experience. In many respects, the conduct of every intelligent citizen is based upon ideas which he acquires from his neighbors. A little of his knowledge comes from the research of technicians. Much of it comes from common sense utilization of the experience of others. Every unit of government can and should learn much from its fellows. Such learning will come in part from the research of specialists and in part from the exchange of experience. To accomplish this purpose, adequate lines of communication between the state governments and between the municipal governments must be developed. The federal government can conduct extensive studies to determine the direction which its own course of conduct should take. Now, my question is how can the federal government conduct, or rather afford to conduct, extensive studies, determine its direction? Well, the federal government has access to the counterfeiting operation. They can counterfeit whatever kind of funds they want, run whatever deficits they want, to be able to fund whatever studies they want. They go on to say, states and municipalities cannot so well afford such studies. Well, why would that be true? That'd be true because the states and the municipalities do not have a counterfeiting operation. They cannot counterfeit the funds, they cannot run budget deficits to be able to afford the studies. It goes on to say, and they should not conduct original research in order to ascertain facts which they might easily learn from their neighbors. So here's the con job. With a counterfeiting operation and massive debt, now they can fund all the extensive studies they want to, manufacture whatever documentation they want to, and use that propaganda to con the states into becoming slaves to the federal government, and at the same time discouraging states from involving themselves in research to see whether or not it's constitutional and lawful or unconstitutional and unlawful, and con the states into being slaves of the federal government. And one of the ways that they do that, they are now collecting all these taxes from the states and from the people, and it's flowing to the federal government, and the federal government says, you either do as you're told or else we're going to take these funds away from you. Now, where did they get those funds in the first place? They got them from we the people of the United States of America. And then they're telling us we have to dance to their tune or else we can't get it back. Well, to heck with that noise. Let's just not give it to them in the first place. So this was a conspiracy and a con job to con the people out of an intelligent research and study of information in order to put a check and a balance on the federal government. They conned the states into it. They conned the people into it. So I'm going to ask you a question now. Where have you ever seen a law that required anybody to file an income tax return? Have you ever seen a law that required anybody to have a Social Security number? Have you ever seen a law that required you to participate in those programs that made it mandatory for you to buy those insurance policies to join that USDC jurisdiction and to be a slave of the USDC jurisdiction? Did you ever see a law? No, you heard it from your neighbors. Okay, so what we want to do is we just want to repeat to ourselves that you've heard all these things from the whisperings of the neighbors. You've never seen a law. From now on, you're going to adamantly insist when anybody tells you that you have to do ABC, you're going to say, okay, I demand that you show me that law. Number two, you're going to demand that they show you that it's constitutional, not unconstitutional, because if it infringes upon your right of pursuit of life, liberty, happiness, the free use of your property without restraint, and they're interfering in your jurisdiction, and you can tell them no, that you are not going to comply with an unconstitutional statute. Okay, then the book goes on to say what the Council of States Governments is. The Council of State Governments is an agency established to solve by cooperative action of the states those problems of an interstate character over which the federal government has no jurisdiction. Okay, so they're admitting they're trying to invade an area whereby they have no jurisdiction. Well, the jurisdiction that they have no jurisdictional authority over is the jurisdiction of we the people of the United States of America. So, once again, they're admitting that their intent was to overthrow the sovereign governing power of the United States of America, we the people of the United States of America. And this Council of States Government book is highly recommended for reviewing purposes. It has the pictures of the representatives. It has the names of the representatives that conspired to overthrow our jurisdiction. And this should go down in history as these people should go down in history as communists and traitors who overthrew the sovereign power of we the people to govern over our government employees in the United States of America. They should not go down historically as having any kind of an honor glory benefited to them for having overthrown our founding fathers' constitutional republican form of government. In the Council of States Governments book, you will find that this study was funded by the Spellman Fund that was funded by the Rockefeller family, John D. Rockefeller in specific, and they created the first Council of States Governments building in Chicago in order to bring all the representatives together to start working on this conspiracy to establish this new governmental power to overthrow the sovereign jurisdiction of the states and the sovereign jurisdiction of we the people of the United States of America. As part of session one of this presentation, I said that we would learn and know the problem. So stand up. Walk into your bathroom and look into the mirror. That's where you'll find the problem. Because we the people, the United States of America, did not govern over our government, our governmental employees. We did not study. We did not learn. We did not question authority. When they told us we had a requirement to file these returns, we didn't do that. What do? We listened to the whisperings of the neighbors. They told you required to file an income tax return, you did it. They told you required to pay taxes, you did it. They told you required to get a Social Security number, you did it. You never asked them where the law was that required you to do these things. So through their propaganda campaign, they got all the neighbors whispering that we have to do all these things, and that's how they implemented the tax system in this country, by the propaganda campaign at the whisperings of the neighbors. A very, very successful campaign. And the way they did it is that, number one, the Income Tax 1913 16th Amendment, never gave the government any new taxing power. And the evidence of that is, additional evidence, aside from the fact they didn't do it, is in 1939 they passed the Public Employees Tax Salary Act. That allowed the government to tax public employees on their pay for the privilege of working for government. Now, if the 16th Amendment of the Constitution would have given them that power in 1913, they would not need the Public Employees Tax Salary Act in 1939 to do it. Next, in 1942, they passed the Voluntary Victory Tax Act to raise additional funds for World War II. This was a withholding out of people's pay that sent funds to the Treasury to fund World War II. Now, if they'd had the power with the 16th Amendment of 1913 to be able to tax people's pay and withhold out of their pay, they would not have had to have the 1942 Voluntary Victory Tax Act. And the Voluntary Victory Tax Act of 42 was repealed May the 29th of 1944. So if you're still filing and paying the income tax, which is a withholding on your paycheck, you're still helping to win World War II. Now, if you go to Hosea 4:6 of the Bible says we are destroyed for lack of knowledge, and that's on the biblical tape. So, by listening to the whisperings of the neighbors, by not researching, we have lost our sovereignty over our government employees. So the correction of that is to start studying and cease to pay attention to the whisperings of the neighbors and what your government employees tell you to do because they lie. Anytime they ask you for information, you have a right to investigate them under the 1974 Privacy Act. So what you do is you make a long list of questions and you investigate every aspect of what they're doing and why, what the law is that authorizes them to do it, and then you determine whether or not it's constitutional or not. If it's unconstitutional, you bring that to their attention and tell them if they continue with their actions, you'll hold them responsible for a conspiracy to violate their oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America and of the state as the supreme law of the land. Now, we've already shown that the conspiracy by the mere corporate government to overthrow our lawful constitutional government is real. That was done through the Council of States governments. That was a new... Now, you have to understand the seriousness of this. The Constitution only established four branches of government. Established the jury as the sovereign power to control the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. And that's all the branches of government that were established to govern this country. Now, what they've done is through the Council of States governments, they have established a brand new form of government, not authorized by constitutional law, to function in interstate commercial regulatory powers to invade the people's jurisdiction and destroy our liberty. That's the one that we have to correct. That's the one we have to move out. That's the one that is financed by the foreign financial powers. Now, the nature and application of the income tax, how to lawfully avoid it. Very simple. Income is properly defined as a measurement that they use to determine what your insurance premium payment is for the benefits you made yourself eligible for. So eliminate the benefits, now you don't have to pay the tax anymore. As a matter of fact, people who do not have eligibility for benefits have no income. You have an exchange of your labor for wherewithal that you're allowed to use in any way you want to without taxation. Since you're not eligible for benefits, you don't have to pay any funds out of your pay for deductions to finance the insurance policy. The nature and application of Social Security tax, how to lawfully avoid it. Once again, if you don't have a Social Security number, you are external to the Internal Revenue Code, not internal. Now, I'm going to give you a lesson on the Internal Revenue Code. Internal Revenue Code, what does that mean to you? It means internal. It governs things that are internal to the code. Okay, now what's internal to the code? Social Security, Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, Railroad Retirement Act, and excise taxes. So, if you're not engaged in those programs, you're external to the code, you're not internal. So if you don't have a Social Security number, that doesn't apply. If not, in the Railroad Retirement Act, that doesn't apply. You're not a licensed alcohol, tobacco, firearms dealer, that does not apply. And that would mean you'd be external code to the code. Correction, I'm going to say again. That means that you would be external to the code, not internal to the code. Therefore, you would be not a person subject to filing and paying and reporting these taxes. You would have no income. Your name associated with their number would not go through their office. Therefore, you would not be punished for having revenues. Now, remember, I says their number. That Social Security number is their number. It's not your number. If you look on the back of the Social Security card, it claims that it's their property. So every time you use their property, i.e. the Social Security number, to go out and utilize it for some kind of a benefit in the system, what you're doing is you're being punished for using that card. You have to pay an insurance premium payment for the benefit of using that card to get benefits from the system. So cease to use it and send it back to them. From now on, you say you have no number. I never had a number. Why? Because you have a power to revoke that ab initio. That means from the outset, on the grounds that it was brought upon you by fraud and misrepresentation. The consumer fraud laws simply do not allow insurance companies to sell insurance without divulging all the terms and conditions of the contracts, and they have not done that. It's almost impossible even to get a copy of the Social Security Act.